Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who discusses Attorney General John Ashcroft's decision to recuse himself from the ongoing investigation into the allegation that Bush administration officials leaked the identity of a CIA covert operative. Author and columnist Tom Englehart, who takes a hard look at the war in Iraq over the past year and concludes that the U.S. empire struck out. And Tom Hansen of the Mexico Solidarity Network, who talks about the changes the Zapatista movement and NAFTA have wrought in Chiapas since the guerrilla group launched its rebellion there 10 years ago. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Every year, more than 500,000 people across the globe die from gun violence. In Rio de Janeiro, guns are the leading cause of death for young men in Brazil. In response, progressive Brazilian President Luiz Lula Inácio da Silva proposed a tax on all gun sales to fight hunger in a recent summit by the G8 industrialized nations. But the G8 dismissed Lula's gun tax. The Bush administration, representing the largest gun manufacturing and exporting nation, opposed any tightening of existing international rules on guns. Activists insist that international treaties, such as the Geneva Convention and the United Nations Charter, ban arming governments that engage in torture or genocide. Last October, Amnesty International, Oxfam, and over 500 gun control groups launched the Control Arms campaign to pressure governments to end sales of small arms that will likely be used in committing human rights abuses. In conflicts across the globe, small arms sales, both legal and illegal, have a way of inflaming existing tensions. When Somalia descended into civil war in the early 1990s, assault rifles, pistols, and revolvers flooded into neighboring Kenya, creating a crime wave there. In the deadly wars in Central Africa, such as Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Amnesty International discovered weapons from as far away as North Korea, China, Russia, and several Eastern European countries. On December 26, 1993, 21-year-old Brandon Tina, a young female transsexual, was stabbed to death in Nebraska, a case that later inspired the Oscar-winning movie Boys Don't Cry. Brandon reversed her birth name from Tina Brandon when she decided to live her life as a boy. A decade later, one of the killers, John Lauder, sits on death row. Co-defendant Marvin Neeson testified against Lauder in exchange for a life sentence. Brandon's mother is outraged at her daughter's treatment by Sheriff Charles Lowe, who made fun of her sexuality after she filed a rape complaint against two attackers who later killed her. For 6 days after the rape complaint, Sheriff Lowe refused to make an arrest. According to the BBC, Lowe was later censured by Nebraska's Supreme Court for extreme and outrageous conduct in the case. Brandon's murder raised the profile of attacks against transgendered people, which continue. 39 transsexuals were killed in 2002, including the case of Gwen Araujo of Newark, California, a 17-year-old boy who lived as a girl. He was beaten, raped, and murdered after several men at a party discovered his biological sexuality. Gwen Smith, who runs the Remembering Our Dead website that monitors attacks against transgendered people, says of Brandon's murder a decade ago, "It was very shocking and it was a wake-up call. There have been changes in Nebraska since Brandon was killed. It was something that shamed the community, like the murder of Matthew Shepard in Wyoming in 1998. The Nation magazine reports that the Republicans in the U.S. Senate are pushing to revive their stalled energy bill. Late in 2003, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist pulled the bill over opposition to protections given oil companies that made the gasoline additive methyl tertiary butyl ether, or MTBE, a pollutant that has contaminated fresh water across the U.S. The provision authored by House Majority Leader Tom DeLay would have protected these oil companies from any financial liability from an estimated $140 billion MBTE cleanup cost. Although gasoline makers claim they were forced to make MTBE to oxygenate gasoline in 1990 in order to meet clean air standards, critics say there was a cleaner alternative. Ethanol, which is water-soluble and biodegradable, was available to refiners. In 2002, a California state jury found Shell, Texaco, and Tosco guilty of irresponsibly manufacturing and distributing MBTE, which they knew would contaminate drinking water supplies. Now, oil giants are pressuring their friends in Congress for protection. If the delay provision passes, MBTE producers could walk away scot-free. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
As 2003 came to a close, Attorney General John Ashcroft announced that he would recuse himself from the Justice Department's investigation into an alleged White House leak that blew the cover of covert CIA agent Valerie Plame, the wife of former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Wilson believes that the leak was intended to punish his public refutation of President Bush's claim that Iraq was seeking uranium in the African nation of Niger for a nuclear weapons program. The White House had sent Wilson to Africa in 2002 to investigate the matter, but ignored his findings. President Bush repeated the charge in his January State of the Union speech, using it as a key justification for war. John Ashcroft has appointed U.S. Attorney Patrick Fitzgerald to lead the investigation and report to his deputy, James Comey. But Mr. Ashcroft's recusal comes months after critics called for his departure from the case and falls short of demands that a truly independent special counsel take charge. The stakes are enormously high for President Bush, who is running for re-election, given the damage which could result from any indictments charging White House aides with involvement in a serious political crime. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with retired 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who discusses Attorney General Ashcroft's decision to recuse himself from the case and suspicions that the Bush administration may be trying to run out the clock in an effort to suppress any bad news until after this November's presidential election.
Patrick Fitzgerald, he is by no means an independent investigator. He reports to Comey, who is the Deputy Attorney General. He's a presidential appointee, and so in no way can this be looked on as an independent special counsel. He's not an outsider, he's an insider, and FBI and justice lawyers are brought up to do what they're told, and it may not be Ashcroft telling him directly, but it's a fair supposition that Ashcroft will tell Fitzgerald the parameters within which he must work, and he'll tell him through Comey, who happens to be a personal friend of Fitzgerald, and that's not any good either.
What are some of your concerns about the games that could be played with this investigation to reduce any potential damage to the Bush administration as they enter an election year?
Yeah. Well, everything, of course, is pointed toward November right now. And it's a good guess, I think, that if Fitzgerald is told to take his time, do a really thorough investigation, and if it goes past the election time, that's fine. That's fine. You just take the time you need here. Then they will be able to avoid a lot of political flack by saying, whoops, the matter is still under investigation going into the election and through it. I see that game being played on the topic A issue. Uncertainty as to whether Saddam Hussein actually had any weapons of mass destruction. Now, that uncertainty is dwindling to virtually nil since they've been there for, what, 7-8 months now and nothing has been found. Still, administration officials are saying at this point that they'll probably keep looking for at least another year. Well, what does that say to me? That says to me that as election time approaches, the administration will be able to say, well, wait a second now, we haven't stopped looking for these weapons of mass destruction. We still may find them and avoid a lot of the heat that way.
Is there anybody in Congress right now, in your view, who will press this point with the concern that you have that for political motivations, we may not see a speedy conclusion to this investigation and fix blame where it belongs?
Well, I really regret to have to say it this way, but no, I don't. Now, Chuck Schumer of New York has been way out in front in trying to get to the bottom of this investigation. And so I was really shocked when, right after Christmas, when all this was announced, he said, well, this is great. I see the glasses being, as he put it, three-quarters full in the light of Ashcroft's decision to recuse himself and to appoint Fitzgerald as a special counsel. Well, I don't see it that way. I think that's gilding the lily. I think maybe Chuck Schumer was a little bit too much in the holiday spirit in those days, because this is a cosmetic thing. What they should have done, what everyone knows they should have done, was to appoint a true complete outsider to be the special counsel. Justice Department regulations provide for that. There is no reason in the world that they would not have done that, except one reason, and that is that they have something very sensitive to hide.
Now, I wanted to go into a recent development. Some listeners have, of course, read about this. White House officials have been asked by U.S. investigators to sign a form to free reporters from any pledges of confidentiality made. And this, of course, refers to six journalists who say they were approached by someone in the White House that revealed Valerie Plame's identity. What's your sense of where this is going? Could this potentially free up reporters to do exactly that, to point out who in the White House might have revealed this covert information?
Well, this is the glass, if not half full, this is the glass a quarter full aspect here. There are some positives. And Ambassador Joseph Wilson, for example, expresses confidence in the career officials, the career investigators of the FBI and Justice Department, that they'll do the right thing. Well, I hope he's right about that. One reason he would believe that is because these career officials, they know what it's like to have your cover blown, and especially blown for political reasons. That really should be beyond the pale. So there's some prospect that they will feel strongly about that. And then, as you mentioned, Scott, the fact that Plame was identified as a CIA agent to no fewer than six journalists, well, you know, that's cause for hope, it seems to me. And I think that Valerie and her husband, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, are pretty savvy politically, pretty savvy procedurally. And my guess is that they are sure that at least one of those six journalists is willing to come forward and to say, look, this is beyond the pale. This should not happen in a democracy. And it was, whoever it was, Karl Rove, Dick Cheney, whoever it was, that called me and said, hey, did you know that Ambassador Wilson, that pinko liberal, that his wife works for the CIA? So I think it is possible that at least one of these people will come forward, and that's the positive part of this. And if that happens, I do hope that Fitzgerald will take the bit in his teeth and proceed very quickly to indict whoever is responsible for this felony.
That was 27-year veteran CIA analyst Ray McGovern, who until his retirement in 1990 led one of two CIA teams conducting the most secret daily intelligence briefings at the White House. His recent article, Don't Be Fooled, Still No Independent Investigation of Leak of CIA Identity, can be read online at www.truthout.org. As the war in Iraq continues to grind on into the new year, the Bush administration does its best to paint a happy face on a conflict that daily claims the lives of Iraqi civilians, aid workers, U.S. soldiers, and their allies. Iraqi insurgents shot down an American helicopter near the city of Fallujah on January 2nd, killing one soldier and wounding another. Despite an agreement to hand over power to an Iraqi government by July 1st, U.S. and British troops will likely remain in Iraq for years to come. According to the British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, troops from America and Britain may very well stay in Iraq through 2007. In another sign of rising discontent in the ranks of soldiers fighting the war in Iraq, the Pentagon announced several orders that will prevent thousands of enlisted men and women from leaving the military service, even if they are eligible to do so. The Army, which constitutes most of the 130,000 soldiers serving in Iraq, is now offering a reenlistment bonus of up to $10,000 in order to stem the flow of soldiers departing the service. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and columnist Tom Engelhart, whose recent article titled The Empire Strikes Out 2003, Imperial Gong Show Year, takes a hard look at events over the past year, including the Bush administration's war in Iraq and the fortunes of the White House neocons' blueprint for world domination.
2002, if you think about it, was what I would call the year of the new Rome. It was the year in which the United States, the Bush administration at least, as the kind of international Greta Garbo, said, I want to be alone. And they issued their nuclear policy review. They issued their the Bush Doctrine. They tore up a whole bunch of treaties. And many of their backers talked quite proudly about taking up the imperial burden, about the fact that we would be a new Rome, that there would be a Pax Americana, and so on and so forth. This was a great dream inside the Beltway, kind of a utopian dream, or maybe a dystopian dream, depending on how you think about it. But the striking thing to me about 2003 is that by the end of that year, really by the fall of that year, all the people talking about New Rome, future empire, and so on and so forth had fallen remarkably silent on the subject. And they had, largely because our legions had set off and fallen into the nearest nation-building ditch. The kind of neocon plan or thinking had been that they would, in essence, drive through Iraq, and it would be like, if you remember the 60s, if you remember the domino theory, it was kind of a reverse domino theory. In the 60s, American leaders were convinced that if any bit of turf on Earth fell, it would be the first domino in a series that, of course, would drop the whole world into the lap of world communism and so on and so forth. Our neocons in the Bush administration had the feeling that if they simply headed for Iraq, they would actually be pushing the domino over, and one country after another would fall. Iran would fall, Syria would fall, the Palestinians would be left to make a peace of the defeated with the Israelis. The dominoes would fall all the way to North Korea. Now, obviously, we know in what was really a kind of catastrophic year, and this is why I called it a kind of a gong show year. It was like they began their performance, and a huge hook came out and pulled them off stage. I mean, they're not literally off stage, but in terms of the dreams of a great moment, if you think about this present moment, all those countries that were in our gun sights back in, say, April, May, June, the road to Damascus seems closed, we're offering aid to Iran, we're letting the Chinese negotiate for us with, you should even say the Chinese communists with North Korea. You could go through a whole list of these things and you'd see that in essence, all these basically utopian plans for reordering the world have been sucked into Iraq, you know, and are stuck there, in a sense. And so in a way, although the Bush administration's spinning it somewhat differently, obviously, it's been a kind of catastrophic year for their dreams. That's what I would say. Now, I think it's also been a catastrophic year for the dreams of those who are critics, like myself as well. I mean, it's been a terrible year to live through. But it is interesting to think that this kind of great imperial moment lasted such a short time.
Do you think the perception game will go in Bush's favor in the coming year in 2004? Do you think the American people will be convinced that being in Iraq is the right thing to do and that George W. Bush and his advisors, the neocons, did the right thing?
Iraq, as a kind of ongoing disaster, is going to continue, I believe, through the year and beyond. But I think the question is less, will they be able to bring the troops home, which they have little intention of doing, but whether they'll be able, in essence, to bring the press home, the media home. Not in the literal sense. There are obviously going to be reporters in Iraq and so on and so forth. But the question is, will the kind of steady drip-drip of casualties, which is at a relatively low level, if they don't happen to be your kids, obviously, whether that steady drip-drip of casualties, of problems, of various little catastrophes in Iraq will become regularized and migrate to the back pages, as it's really done for the last 2 weeks. Well, we've had, you know, if you watch, say, primetime TV, you get 10 to 15 minutes of straight news on flights that were canceled, color-coded alerts, all this stuff that really takes attention away. I think the Bush people are going to conduct a fierce, you might say, action at home to keep the focus as much as possible off Iraq. I think the horror for them is that they thought they were going to drive through the Middle East and reorganize the world that way, and instead they find a bunch of kind of no-name insurgents in the Middle East, in Iraq, more or less in the driver's seat. And I think that's the great frustration. And Iraq has, in essence, eaten the rest of their foreign program.
Well, Tom Engelhardt, just maybe a final question. We can end on a brighter note than what we've been harping about the last year. 2003 was also the year, as you mentioned in your piece, it was the year when millions of people literally came into the streets to try and prevent the war in Iraq. And the New York Times, that had pretty much been ignoring protesters in the streets of their own home-based country in Washington and New York, basically declared that the mobilization for peace, the anti-war activists, were the world's other major superpower. A bright spot?
Yes. There probably has never been, I can't think of an example anyway, of you know, first of all, of such demonstrations against a war before it began, nor of demonstrations at such a global level, nor of demonstrations without obvious leaders, without obvious parties. The estimates are 10 to 30 million people went out into the streets. And it reminds us that there are other forces in the world, and even the worst of situations sometimes calls up some very hopeful things. I wouldn't wish, I'm not one of those people who says you need the worst of situations to get the best of things. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But sometimes the worst of warlike situations does call up other forces.
That was author and columnist Tom Engelhart. Read his article titled The Empire Strikes Out 2003, Imperial Gong Show Year, and other timely articles on his website at www.tomdispatch.com.
On January 1st, 1994, an indigenous group in Mexico's poorest state of Chiapas, calling itself the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, or EZLN, declared war on the Mexican government, demanding cultural and economic autonomy. The declaration was tied to generations of bigotry against the indigenous population and the implementation of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which the Zapatistas opposed, predicting its neoliberal policies would further impoverish Mexico's peasants. Over the last decade, the Zapatista military's chief spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos, has captured the imagination and respect of many in Latin America for his thoughtful essays and poetry, linking the struggle of the dispossessed in Mexico with those of other indigenous and impoverished peoples across the world. After years of military skirmishes, the EZLN and the Mexican government worked to resolve their differences through negotiations resulting in a document known as the San Andres Accord. This agreement, signed by the Zapatistas and the government, would have conferred a degree of autonomy on indigenous communities in Chiapas. But the government of President Vicente Fox and the federal legislature refused to ratify the accord. Violence against indigenous campesinos and Zapatista activists at the hands of paramilitary groups linked with the Mexican military has continued, including the 1997 massacre of 45 peasants in the town of Octayal, Chiapas. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Tom Hansen, coordinator of the Mexico Solidarity Network, who talks about the changes both NAFTA and the Zapatistas have wrought in Chiapas in the last 10 years and the struggles that lie ahead.
The Zapatista uprising was an uprising first and foremost for indigenous rights, but also included a very powerful critique of the neoliberal model, of which NAFTA and free trade regimes are a central element. NAFTA has had a devastating impact on the countryside throughout Mexico, not just in indigenous communities. About 20% of the Mexican population is campesinos, and they live off of their production on small plots of land. And almost all of them produce corn. But the importation of cheap corn from United States corporations, mainly Archer Daniels Midland and ConAgra, has basically destroyed the corn market in Mexico. And this has a lot to do with NAFTA, with corporate subsidies in the United States, and with the lack of support on the part of the Mexican government, which was mandated by NAFTA, ending subsidies to small producers. And so corn is actually sold on the Mexican market for below the cost of production. And this has forced about a million small and medium-sized producers to leave the land and look elsewhere for some kind of a meager income. And most of them have migrated either to large cities or to the border region or increasingly to the United States as undocumented workers.
There was a celebratory march of Zapatistas in 2001. It was called the March for Dignity, and it went from Chiapas to Mexico City, stopping in cities and villages along the way. People arrived in Mexico City hoping for a ratification of the San Andres Accords, but that did not happen. Since then, recently, I understand that the Zapatistas have developed something called the Junta of Good Government. What is that all about?
Right. I actually had the privilege of participating in that march from Chiapas to Mexico City, and it was a historic event that lasted 2 weeks. We talked to literally hundreds of thousands of people, the largest gathering in the center of Mexico City in many, many years, many decades happened when the Zapatista leadership came to Mexico City. And they demanded implementation of the San Andreas Accords, and of course the Fox administration and the federal Congress failed them. And so the Zapatistas are implementing their concept of autonomy, the concept of autonomy that was outlined in the San Andreas Accords, without any kind of official recognition or support. And one of the major aspects of this has been the implementation of the Juntas de Buen Gobierno, or the Juntas of Good Government. There's five juntas. They're composed of two representatives from each of the autonomous municipalities. I had the opportunity to meet with some of the juntas a couple of months ago, and they're functioning very well. And it's an effort to extend Zapatismo and Zapatista political power throughout the Zapatista regions without the authority of the Mexican government actually recognizing them. They actually refuse funding from the central government. That's one of the tenets of Zapatismo, to not accept federal handouts. The three main priorities of the Juntas de Buen Gobierno are the establishment of independent autonomous schools, a healthcare system, and economic programs, mainly through the establishment of cooperatives, production cooperatives, and regional distribution warehouses. They're getting a reduced amount of international funding from international solidarity groups, and so they're basically building this from the communities. One of the things that happened when they established the Juntas de Buen Gobierno is they began offering free medical care to all indigenous people in the region. You didn't have to be a Zapatista to get free medical care. Everybody got free medical care.
I saw on your website at a big meeting that happened this past summer, some women spoke out, and one of them, Comandante Fidelia, was talking about the need for women to step forward and to take an equal role in civic life there. And she said, "We are going to make compulsory our respect as the women we are, even if the men make their sad little faces." How has the role of women changed since 1994?
The Zapatistas talk about January 1st, 1994 as being the second uprising, the second revolution in the communities. And the establishment of women's rights was really the first revolution that they talk about, which really came to fruition in 1992 with the establishment of a document that outlined women's rights in the communities. I mean, what space women have now in indigenous communities, not only Zapatista communities, but also non-Zapatista communities, is largely due to this women's revolution that happened as part of Zapatismo. But it's a process that's going to take a generation or two generations to come to full fruition.
That was Tom Hansen of the Mexico Solidarity Network. For more information, call the network at area code 773-583-7728 or visit the group's website at www.mexicosolidarity.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.